Choke Points, brought to you by 2020lifestyles.com. Today, 4th of July, Chris is here with some fireworks parking etiquette.
Yeah, not only fireworks parking, but fireworks just getting around the shows. You know, and I'm always amazed by the way people try to catch the dozens of fireworks shows put around the Western Washington each year, including doing some very dangerous things. I know you've heard about these. So I'm going to focus on the Seattle show over Lake Union today, because you can apply it pretty much to any show. But we all know that the best place to watch the show over Lake Union is on the Ship Canal Bridge.
Yes.
But that, of course, doesn't mean you can stop on the shoulder during the show,
no.
Which people continue to do. We see this every year with people who try to time their drive to catch the show, and then they actually stop on the bridge to watch it. That is a huge no-no. People actually do this.
Really?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why the state actually closes the freeway ramps in and around there, but you know, with about a half an hour to go to a half an hour after, to keep people from parking on those ramps and hanging out during the show. So that if you want to watch the fireworks, do what everybody else does. Get up early, park in somebody else's neighborhood, and then walk to Gas Works Park. Now, I'm only partly serious about this because I want you to be courteous when invading Fremont and Wallingford to park for the day. Don't block driveways. Don't block alleys. Don't park on people's lawns. And if you see cones or garbage cans protecting spaces in front of the homes, do not move them. Residents put them there to preserve their own spaces, and they get very, very angry when you move them.
Yes.
So that is a clear sign. I mean, it would have been akin of, you know, back in the day, someone sitting on the front porch with a shotgun, but you don't move those things. That's just not kosher.
And the thing is, you don't do yourself any advantage by parking close to the fireworks because you can't get out anyway.
I mean, and that's another very important part of this whole thing.
The most successful getaway I had from the Gas Works fireworks was the time I parked a mile away on one of those little used on-ramps to 99, and we just walked there and got out pretty quickly. If you try to park close in, you're going to be stuck till 1 a.m.
Yeah, easily. And you're right. And you can walk faster than you'll be able to drive, definitely. So yeah, that's your little guide. Don't stop on the freeway. Don't move garbage cans in front of houses, and park further away and get a little get your steps in.
Okay, what about if you're traveling to a destination you haven't been to for a while?
Well, okay, here's one something that we should think about because if you haven't been to your place in a while, the state has been building a lot of things that maybe are outside the Seattle core that don't get the attention. Some of the highways here and there, they've been making improvements, and a lot of roundabouts have been going in around over the last year. So say maybe you haven't driven your highway in a while, you might come across a roundabout. So just be prepared to deal with roundabouts. I know most people hate them. I think they're great. They actually work well. So, you know, just be prepared for that. The other thing, this is great. If you're heading over to the Shelton area for this holiday, or maybe you're already there, you will likely see the state's first attempt at a more vigorous zipper merge on your way home.
Really?
We talked about this in a choke point a couple of weeks ago. The state has first installed the first verbal signs to promote zipper merging where Highway 101 southbound merges with Highway 8 just west of Olympia. So if you're coming home from Shelton over the weekend, this might be the first time you see this. This is a spot where drivers routinely get over way too early when the right lane is ending, creating a huge backup. The right lane remains open. The new signs actually read, "Use both lanes when congested," and "Take turns merging when congested." So they're seeing how the
congratulations
state,
you got them to pay attention.
Yes, and we have new verbal signs that a lot of people have said if they were more explicit to kind of tell us what to do, we might pay attention better. So it'll be interesting to see how these signs work out, because I'd like to see this put throughout the state. Like I told you, in Montana, they have a variety of different signs talking about use both lanes, then merge at the end, alternate at the end. So this is the first attempt.
No
at that.
Zipper pictures?
There are some zipper pictures in Montana. There aren't yet in our state. These are the first ones that have gone in as they kind of dip their toe into a little bit more vigorous enforcement of the zipper merge.
Okay, what about the ferries over the holiday?
Well, as you can expect, prepare for waits. Primarily on Saturday, Sunday, Monday on the get back days, because chances are you're probably already where you need to be by ferry today. It's pretty interesting. The ferry system says about 1 million people are going to be using the ferry system from the 28th of June, so last Friday, through the upcoming Monday, July 8th. That's a ton.
That's
a ton of people. So check the ferry schedule carefully. Some will have extra runs because of the holiday or because of the weekend. Some others might actually be on holiday restrictions today. So be prepared. Check your schedule. Expect a lot of extra people. And keep in mind, Fireworks are illegal on the ferries.
Really?
They're also illegal on the ferry docks.
So you can't take your Roman candle aboard the ferry and just shoot it from the bow of the ship?
No, well, if you do that, you will certainly get the attention. But the state patrol, the state troopers are going to be looking for this at their, you know, on the docks and on board. They are illegal. So if you're taking them over to your destination, hide them well in your stuff and don't shoot them off the ferry.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're illegal.
Can't shoot them from your car window while driving down I-5. That would be illegal, too.
No, that's, I mean, we had a case of that, a week ago, where we had there was a Roman candle fight down in, it was either Kent. And, you know, that never ends up good. So, no, don't shoot fireworks out of moving cars.
It's your nation's birthday. Don't be a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, just because it's our birthday doesn't mean you have the right to blow up a chunk of it. But you can go out and have fun. Just be smart about it.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. Enjoy the 4th.
A Seattle neighborhood was once home to a big local fireworks company that manufactured and imported all kinds of festive explosives and put on big shows all over the West. And it's a mostly forgotten chapter of local history. So here to tell us more about it is our resident historian, Cairo Radio's Felix Bunnell.
Hey, happy 4th of July, Dave.
Thank you.
I spoke yesterday with Gloria Hitt Cobble. She's in her 80s. Her grandfather, Thomas Gabriel Hitt, founded the Hitt Fireworks Company in Seattle in 1905. He was born in England and trained as a pharmacist, so he had a chemical background. First came to Victoria, B.C. around 1900, and then to Seattle and a hillside in the Rainier Valley near Columbia City, where he built a house and a factory, which for safety reasons was really just a series of isolated sheds. To hear his granddaughter tell it, T.G. Hitt was the Northwest's king of fireworks in an era when fireworks were king.
He did extravaganzas. That's what he loved, you know. And there was no TV, cell phones, all those things then. This was his passion, and actually, well, I see the fireworks today. To me, they don't hang in the air as long. They don't burn as long. And when I look at it, I think his formula for shells, which was either a single or two or three burst, you know, like we see today, they seem to hang in the air longer before they burned out. And that's just the impression I have.
And, you know, Hitt Fireworks did more than just the kinds of shows we see today, and like the one that you saved a few years ago, Dave. You know, I always like to thank you for that because it's in my neighborhood. Anyway, Hitt did pyrotechnics for Hollywood films, including Gone with the Wind and All Quiet on the Western Front. So it makes sense that Gloria Cobble says her grandfather did something for those big public outdoor shows that were called set pieces. This involved a lot of construction of things that would be burned down. They involved complicated designs that recreated battles or had actual moving parts or just featured giant flags.
So the set pieces were huge. And I can remember two specifically, besides the big American flag, which always closed the show. But other than that, it was a Dutch girl, you know. And then they had ropes or something on the legs so that they could pull the legs back and forth, you know, so that like that was dancing. And the other was a Navy ships firing at each other, two of those. And I remember those specifically. They were big productions. They just don't do that anymore.
Yeah, and so she would travel around with her grandfather and her father as a young girl and then in her teen years to these places like Playland up in Shoreline, and they would do these shows.
They'd actually build a
set.
Kind of a rack that would be then decorated with fireworks.
Exactly, or some kind of a three-dimensional set of something that they would burn down and blow up and explode like they did for the movie. So it's a whole different level of fireworks, very different era. And T.G. Hitt, you know, even well into his old age, was a very hands-on guy, particularly when it came to baseball games and fishing derbies, and a kind of explosive called a maroon.
The maroons, the one that go up with a big flash and bang, he used that at Sixth Stadium every time they had a home run. He would be sitting there waiting for a home run, and as soon as he got one, he'd send one of those maroons up. And he also spent time, you know, sending the same maroons up to open fishing derbies all around Seattle. I remember he'd get up early in the morning to get over there to fire the thing to start the derbies.
And here it was, I thought the SS Mariner at the Old Kingdom. I thought that was our generation's idea to have fireworks go off every time the Mariners hit a home run, which wasn't that often back in the old days. Yeah, yeah. So T.G. Hitt, her grandfather died in 1958, and her father, Ray, continued the business into the early 70s. Its peak years are really the 30s and 40s, maybe into the 50s. The last big fireworks show they did, I think, was with Ivor back in the 70s. And Gloria Cobble mentioned how much better her grandfather's fireworks were, especially in her memory. She says his old chemical formulas are long gone, but that hasn't stopped people from trying to find them.
One professor from California called. He was writing a book on pyrotechnics. And he said, do you know where the formulas are? Do you have any idea where the formulas? Well, when I was in high school working, coming up there, I used to go in the back room and sit there with Granddad, and he'd have me retype all the formulas on cards, you know, that kind of thing. And I said, I don't know anything about them. I don't know what they did with them. And then he tried the ploy to say, well, you know, we do have a couple of the formulas. I said, well, that's great. I don't have any. So...
So the, you know, the old factory sheds down the Rainier Valley were torn down back in the early 80s. The site of the old factory is now a Seattle park called Hits Hill. Gloria Cobble and her family live in her grandfather's old house right next door. It's very cool. So if, wow. if you walk through that park, which I did the other day, and I scoured it, I couldn't find any evidence of there having been anything there other than trees and rocks.
No plaque, no nothing?
Nothing. I mean, there's a sign at either end that calls it Hits Hill, but there's no yeah. interpretation that say here once stood this amazing firework factory. And so my last question, you know, to Gloria Cobble was, given that it's, you know, 4th of July 2019, you know, how and where will she celebrate the holiday?
Right here, thinking about it. Once in a while, I can see it from Kirkland and so on. I can see some of that. You know, I watch it on TV. I don't, you know, I had years of watching it fired. And the funny part is, even in a long distance, I can hear the boom. And I thought, oh, the fireworks have started. So it's ingrained in me. But I thank God, Felix, that I'm the age I am, and I'm up here with the squirrels.
She sounds like a firecracker herself.
She's great. Yeah, what a great family history. And I really want to thank the Rainier Valley Historical Society, for who I reached out to a couple of days ago, and they were telling me about this. And I'd heard a little bit about the Hit Firework Factory before, but never knew there was a family member still around. And just what a great local story.
So being it was a local factory with their own custom formulas, they had to test them somewhere. Where would they test these things? Do you have any idea?
You know, they would go out. She said her father would go out. They would test some things. They made stuff during World War II. They made smoke flares. They made other things for the Army during World War II. And they would test them. They'd float them off. They'd go down to Lake Washington and float them off on a float, like push them out in the lake and ignite them on a long fuse that way. She said her grandfather was really committed to safety. Like, he sort of invented safe and sane. Like, she wasn't allowed to go in the factory as a young child. And everything was done in a way that was just, you know, right by the book. They didn't do anything. They didn't take any risks, which is probably explains why they had such great longevity as a company, to be around here for decades doing all these big professional shows that people would go and see. And they also imported stuff like ladyfingers and those little fireworks from China. They had firework stands that they operated themselves. So it was, I mean, her grandfather was really into it. He also made perfume in the basement. He had a lab in the basement, which she said he called his laboratory, not his laboratory.
Because
he was an English guy.
Yes, of course.
And it's just really interesting. Seattle in the late 19th century attracted so many people from so far away that shaped the city that became in the 20th century. And T.G. Hitt was one of them.
Hmm. Great story. And all Felix's stories are at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Hey, and thanks for saving the fireworks, Dave.
Yeah.
I know you get embarrassed about that, but we wouldn't have fireworks in Lake Union where it weren't for you and Tom Douglas.
So it was fun.
Anyway. Yeah.
It's time for today's Daily Dose of Kindness. And today we bring you a story from the small town of Anoka, Minnesota, where one man has attended 1,500 high school graduation parties. I'll let reporter Boyd Hubbard explain.
Good to see you.
Good seeing you too. I'm glad you came.
In Minnesota.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
High school graduation parties have rituals.
Thank you for coming.
The hugs, the games.
Beanbags, gotta do it.
The food, so fine. And the double garage shrine.
Congratulations.
But graduates of Anoka High School have another.
Everybody just loves him.
Him.
Hey!
Anoka grad party staple. Jeff Nelson.
Hey, congratulations, Sarah.
Thanks.
Yeah,
yeah.
I remember the first weekend of June, he had 26 grad parties to go to, and I was like, what?
What?
Thanks for coming.
In the world.
I've been to all these this summer. I went to 175 in June last year. Jackson Haugie. The most I've ever done is 29 in one day. Courtney Garrison. I started at 9 o'clock in the morning, got to my last one at 10 o'clock at night, and I put 186 miles on my car.
An honor, Jeff Nelson.
Good evening.
As well.
How do you not know him is the question, really.
Good luck.
Yeah!
Naming an activity at Anoka High.
I'll be there.
Not attended
yeah.
by the man they call Superfan.
I'll be there.
I know him from him coming to all my gymnastics meets.
Softball, baseball, boys and girls lacrosse, tennis.
And those are just the spring
track
sports.
Yeah.
Not to mention.
See you on Saturday.
Their concerts and plays.
After that performance, how can they not want to?
When Jeff left Anoka High School 43 years ago.
That's me.
He wasn't done.
I loved high school. Oh, it was so much fun.
He just graduated.
Super fan.
To cheerleader.
Thank you for...
For every student thank you for to come.
Thank you for coming.
This is Sidney Baumgartner. I see you at basketball games.
A guy like that.
Carly Barant from volleyball.
Is going to get...
Cam Kramer. He's a pitcher.
Some invitations.
Emily Berg. She was on the dance team.
This is three for us.
Did you, like, drink some coffee?
One, two, three Hikert sisters have now graduated.
And he was here for all of them.
Yep. All the siblings.
Oh, yeah. I guess he knows the house.
He loves the kids.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And turns out love
so cute.
Can be quantified.
My trophy that he gave me for his 1,000th grad party.
Megan Mershman graduated 3 years ago, and still, Jeff's invitations keep coming.
This is number 1499.
I don't even think he eats in the month of June, other than grad parties. That's it. It's walking tacos and pulled pork for the whole month.
Adios.
Never married.
How are you?
No kids of his own.
And oh there you are, Abby.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, yes, you are.
That's amazing.
For the 1,500th grad party.
Just Abby Sullivan, twin sister Alexa.
Yeah.
And a few hundred other Anoka students.
We're both on the quarters.
Jeff Nelson does his best to help raise.
He's been involved at Anoka Key Club for as long as I can remember.
What would life be like without these kids?
It would be really, I don't know what I'd do.
A man who works security.
I'm very fortunate.
Overnight.
I'm very, very, very fortunate.
1, 2, 3.
Keeping his days free for his kids.
He's important to us.
Off to the next one, I guess.
Jeff Nelson lives to be a party.
Hello.
To their success.
Thank you for coming. Yeah.
Boyd Hooper, Carol Evan News.
Couldn't miss this one.
Andover.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And here he is, the man who spends every day gorging on sports, our insider, Danny O'Neill.
Oh, is that a subtle hot dog eating con? You devil, you devil.
Today is the Nathan's famous hot dog eating contest on Coney Island. Has this happened for, I don't know how many years, as long as I can
remember. Too many.
I didn't realize this was an organized sport. So it's got an association and everything.
Put your sarcastic air quotes around that.
Really?
Sport.
So you don't... Oh, well, so I guess we have a fundamental problem here. You don't believe it's a sport.
No.
So we really can't discuss it on the sports
side. Sure, we can. Oh. Some people think it is, and it's going to be televised on ESPN, and that's generally the arbiter of sports.
Is poker a sport?
Poker is not a sport. Poker is a game. ESPN. What? Yeah, good point, Dave. You have bested me with my logic.
So...
Yeah, but poker is definitely not a sport. It's a strategic game. It's very interesting. I could see people who are interested in sports being interested in watching poker.
Well, I mean, a sport involves physical activity, and competitive eating certainly qualifies there. It involves working out and training, and from what I've just read, I mean, I don't follow competitive eating, but Joey Chestnut does the stomach stretching exercises. He practices with oatmeal, you know, just like the batter practices with a heavier bat. So maybe.
Doesn't it sound... Sports should include a bit of athletics, though, right?
Well, that's the thing, though, doesn't it? Don't you have to work out? Don't you have to change your body to suit the sport, and that's what they do.
But is that athletic? Is that athletic?
Is it just exercising the legs and arms that constitute athleticism? What about the internal organs?
Yeah, but
the stomach,
making
and the intestines.
Yourself pliable so it can house the maximum number of hot dogs. Seems to be stretching the bounds. I don't know if
stretching
I can consider...
Stretching is a good word.
I think it's kind of gross. I have a bias against it. I'll admit it.
Gross.
Do you like it?
No, I can't watch it.
Yeah, I'm not that interested. Where it's really, it's, like, spend your time doing something worthwhile.
It's sickening to watch.
There's the training that goes into it. Like, it's undoubtedly really difficult. And... I mean, obviously, if it was easy, you'd have a lot of people that would be willing to get as famous, get the kind of airtime that Joey Chestnut has gotten as the...
Well, he's a prodigy. You can't expect...
But that idea that it's some sort of crowning achievement or that it's an athletic event it's fairly gross to me. Have you seen the other qualifying? I heard on the radio this morning, one of the top rivals to Joey Chestnut. He beat Joey Chestnut in the very prestigious Hooters Wings competition.
Ah, yes.
He also in the Hostess Donuts qualifier.
Now, that's
he
that's
like
tough.
230 Hostess Donuts.
That's
and it
the
was,
Wimbledon of eating, the donuts.
Could you eat? Do you think you could eat 200 in a day?
I have eaten
like not. Let
I've
alone,
eaten a box. I've eaten a box in a day. I'm ashamed to say it, but I did it once.
And how did you feel?
Awful.
Yeah.
Well, mostly guilty. They were delicious.
Oh, really? See,
but I felt guilty.
See, because I've gotten to the point where now, like, I can actually make myself physically feel bad, but by the crud I eat, which is disappointing. Because
you're in good shape,
Yeah, but here's the thing: is what does that mean? Because it used to be like if I was 15, you could just sit there and eat.
I know.
Crud all day long, and you wouldn't feel bad. Like, you'd maybe feel bad about yourself, but it wouldn't be like a physical sensation of, like, I'm sick. I ate too much. Now I get sick. I'm like, oh.
Here's my problem with competitive eating. There's no defense. If there was a rule that said, you know, while Joey's reaching for that 74th hot dog, you can do a dive and try to grab it from him before it gets into his mouth, now that would be a sport.
Is your body your opponent? Because you can't vomit.
No,
like, that's one of the rules.
Well, you can vomit, but it can't touch the table. That's my understanding of it.
Well, how could you vomit without it touching the table?
You turn your head. That's part of your training.
Oh no, I don't think you can physically get sick. I don't think you can be at the table. I think there's a time limit. You cannot get physically sick during that.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think you can spit anything out.
I'll recheck. But I believe...
Doesn't the fact that we're debating the finer points of whether vomiting counts tell you whether or not it's a sport?
This is no different than requiring the new pitcher to pitch to three batters. It's all arbitrary.
Dave, you don't really believe that. Well, that a rule on where you can vomit and whether you vomit on the table or not is similar to...
I consider the rules of debate different when I'm debating you. I'm debating you. Consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds.
I would say this, that your return of serve with the poker analogy really caught me off balance.
I know. I like that.
It was Dave was ready.
He's been reeling ever since.
He just whipped a two-handed
backhand. Let's change the subject. Explain to me why Daniel Vogelbach is not in the home run derby.
People hate fun. a general hatred of fun is the only reason that Daniel Vogelbach is not included there.
Who makes the decision?
Well, I think it's partly players, and I think they get input, and I think ultimately it's Major League Baseball that does. I was disappointed that he wasn't because I think it'd be really, really fun. It probably something has to do with the lack of experience he has, that he's not that well known, and that baseball, as far as a marketability standpoint, that other guys are more. Josh Bell is a player that's going to be in it from Pittsburgh that I think people are excited to see. And maybe it's the fact that Daniel Vogelbach isn't as well known. I think people would love seeing him. I know that I'm intrigued watching him. He's a guy that I stopped to watch what he's doing.
Right. Unfortunately, I don't follow it that closely. So the everybody else that got into it, except for Santana, I hadn't heard of before either. So
yeah, I'm excited. I like the home run derby. I honestly think he'd have a shot to win it.
Yeah.
Is
it the number of home runs or the distance?
It's the number of home runs. And within a period of time, you only get so many pitches to be able to do it. So it's an efficiency contest.
But they're not pitching to try and get the ball past you. They're pitching to you.
They're trying to groove it.
Yeah, okay.
But that's still, you can see guys when they get up there, it can be hard for even an established home run hitter and somebody who knows exactly where he wants it and is used to putting on displays in batting practice, it can be difficult to get into a groove.
Well, it gives him something to shoot for next year.
I know. Yeah. I'm bummed that he's not doing it this year. It would have been really fun.
Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Happy 4th of July.
Same to you.
Nobody blow off any digits.
No, please.
Be safe out there.
That's right. This is Seattle's Morning News, and here is Rachel Bell, who is about to premiere a new episode of her award-winning podcast, Your Last Meal. And this is about ballerinas becoming foodies, because usually ballerina and food don't mix.
That is the stereotype. So my guest on my podcast, which is out right now, is Lauren Weedman. She's an actor. She spent many years in Seattle, so some people might know her name from that. She used to be a Daily Show correspondent. She's been on Curb Your Enthusiasm and New Girl, all kinds of shows. And Lauren is very funny, so she was a little bit uncomfortable talking about such a serious topic, but her mom was a ballerina. And so Lauren grew up with a very complicated relationship to food.
Her lunch was just like licking a rice cracker. Like, she was very, very into how she was always under 90 pounds. And I was like gaining weight. As soon as I hit puberty, I was hiding Little Debbie snack cakes in my closet.
Nice.
So I could, you know, help fill in after the rice cake lunch. So I was starving watching her eat. And so I would sneak food was on a ton of different diets too. Like I was on like Weight Watchers and Nutrisystem and things where there was all these different, I had to go to a hypnotist at one point, but that didn't work. I gained weight going to the hypnotist also because it was across the street from Wendy's.
So as I'm listening to this, the first thing that popped in my mind is a woman in Seattle named Carrie Brunson. And about 10 years ago, there was a lot of buzz in several local newspaper articles around Carrie Brunson because she was a member of the Pacific Northwest Ballet. She was a professional ballerina, but she started a food blog. And, you know, the stereotype is ballerinas don't eat. There's a lot of eating disorders. They're very skinny. And so people were very excited about the fact that this ballerina knew how to cook. And Carrie started getting so into food. She ended up staging, which is basically working for free in a restaurant at an Ethan Stowell restaurant. The connection being that Ethan Stowell's parents are the founding artistic directors.
That's a natural connection.
Of the Pacific Northwest Ballet. So she danced all day.
But then at night, I didn't think about dance. I thought about food and I thought about what I was going to make next and how I was going to write about it and how I was going to photograph it. It was like this little love affair that I had with this other thing.
So at just 26 years old, Carrie decided to retire from ballet. And keep in mind that these dancers make good money. There are benefits. Anybody who's worked in restaurants know that that is not good money. You don't get benefits. You're working long, late hours. She was working in kitchens sometimes with all men who really didn't have very much interest in teaching her, you know, showing her the ropes. So she left the restaurant world. She started at the farmer's market selling juice. And now she owns a couple restaurants in Seattle. So I Googled her recently and I was like, oh my God, she owns one of my favorite ice cream shops. It's called Frankie and Joe's. There are a few locations in Seattle. And she owns a restaurant up on Capitol Hill called Juice Box.
So what is it? So what is the theme exactly of the restaurant she runs?
Plant-based. So Juice Box isn't vegetarian, but it's very vegetable forward. And Frankie and Joe's is a plant-based ice cream shop. So they make their own cashew milk, and then they also use coconut milk, and that's the base. And then their cones are gluten-free, which all of this, I'm not vegan, I'm not gluten-free. Their cones are better than any cones I've ever had.
That's the challenge. If you can make it delicious, then I don't think people are going to worry about what it's made of.
Exactly. She says they have a hurdle to get through because people just think, ugh, how's this going to compare? But if you didn't know that it was not dairy and not gluten, you would have no idea. It's so delicious. But Carrie said that she did have some stereotypical ballerina experiences when she was a child.
It is one of the most challenging things to sort of go through puberty while you're wearing leotard and tights. And then the relationship of your teachers that are trying to help you be successful, and then what they know makes a successful dancer is this certain physique and look. So when you're in that process of your body changing, I don't feel like, at least for me, that the relationship that they created with my body was good for my psyche. 'Cause we were already all comparing ourselves anyway. You're standing in front of a mirror for your entire life. So you're just constantly self-criticizing and looking at other people and being like, why are their legs longer? Or why are my knees bent backwards? Or, you know, why is their foot more pointed than mine? Things you can't necessarily change, but the thing that you can change is how big or small you are.
So she found herself going crazy by comparing herself to others.
It
and
sounds
had to get
that
out.
Way. Yeah, well, I don't think that's why she got out, because that was kind of the early years. And then while she was, you know, dancing professionally, I think that kind of went away. But I'm fascinated by people who completely 180 change careers later in life, because going from dance to restaurants is so different. And I think it's so courageous because you have to start from the bottom and maybe make a lot less money. I'm just always in awe of people who do that.
I know it's a big issue because we go to the ballet. We subscribe for over 20 years. And one of the big issues is, what do you do after your years as a ballet dancer are up? And usually you end up teaching other ballet dancers. This is a very novel career change.
It is. And I think maybe she's lucky that she found that so early in life. 26, you're still pretty young and ready for that. But the podcast is out. It's called Your Last Meal. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher. You can go to yourlastmealpodcast.com. If you don't know anything what I was just talking about, you could just listen to it on your computer.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.